Warm welcome to everyone. And I'd like to really invite you to make yourself comfortable, whatever that means for you. And just kind of imagine that, this could be a time where you can really just relax. So a comfortable position for listening. And I'm always tempted at this point to say, if that's really very different to your meditation posture, then, you might want to investigate some improvements to your meditation posture so it's more convenient for listening in. But obviously, I'm going to resist making that joke. And another thing you might want to do is, you can do that hiding yourself view if you don't want yourself looking back out of the camera. Out of the computer back at you. There are usually these kind of three dots on your picture, and you can make yourself disappear. It's like magic. And in all of this, just feeling welcomed to kind of be at ease, allowing all of ourselves to be welcomed here. And the next thing to say is something general, actually, for all of the retreat is really feel invited to rest your eyes from needing to look at a screen. According to some of the research that I read, if we're looking at a screen, we blink radically less. I mean, really a lot less, maybe six times less. So if it's helpful for you to look at the screen, there's not going to be a lot on the screen. It's just going to be a head and other heads. But feel free to look at the community here, and it's a great support that we have here together. But also feel free to look out of a window or look at a plant or look at a picture, whatever there is in your environment. And enjoy blinking. When we don't blink so much, I think it's what makes our eyes feel tired and then kind of brings on the headache and the whole, online fatigue. Some people call Zoom fatigue because Zoom has kind of gathered so much of the market for these online retreats. But really, just feel invited to look where you would like to be looking. Look at what would be pleasing. So we use this mindfulness quality to select where we want our attention to rest, our visual attention. Where do you want that to be right now? And place it wherever it's helpful. And of course, it can be helpful to see the lips of the person who's speaking. Yeah, so if that's what's helpful, then don't forget you have to do the mindfulness of blinking. You have to blink six times more than you feel the instinct to do so, if the research is correct. So in the first talk, we talked about understanding the human defaults, and then searching our way through to the advanced settings and, turning on the metta and all the rest. Yeah. The defaults were also really kind of beautifully expressed yesterday by Zohar, the default experience for the human being, these hindrances, these obscurations, these blockages that get in the way of finding real happiness, real freedom, real peace. And as I was saying, all of the hindrances themselves are dukkha. Yeah. The Buddha would say many times, what I teach is freedom from dukkha. I teach about dukkha for the freedom from dukkha, from distress, from sorrow, from entanglement. And so the hindrances spoke about yesterday, and of course, we speak about them once and now they're gone. But I'll speak about them in the past tense because, you may remember those days when you used to have hindrances. The greedy desire, really wanting stuff. Or remember those? Yeah. So it seems so long ago. Or the aversion. Yeah, they're not good enough that this moment has to offer, or this next moment. How dare it, be like that? And then the ones related to our kind of energetics, the dullness, the not enough energy. And really, it's the not enough that gets attached to that. Yeah, the not enough. It's just not a lot of energy. But interestingly, and as Zaha was kind of sharing with us, we kind of work with that. In a certain sense, it's not a lot of energy. It can be an appropriate amount of energy at a certain time for certain activities, yeah. To really be slow, to be still, not be putting out a lot of energy. But there's that feeling, it's not enough for this moment. And that gets into that struggle, that difficulty, that entanglement. And then at other times it feels like there's too much energy. Yeah, too much energy for what I'm trying to do here. It's, you know, the too muchness is there. And you see, it's also referring to an activity, yeah. It's like if you went to somewhere where, you know, there's a lot of dancing and energetics and things like this, and someone says, oh, you've come here with too much energy. You know, it's too much energy for what we're trying to do. Yeah, too much bounce, too much enthusiasm, too much whatever it is, trying to fix and juggle and needs more space. Yeah, it's not working. We're not wanting it. We don't want it that way. That becomes the dukkha. Yeah. So exactly as I was saying, it's in that relationship to it that we find the resistance, that we find the hindrance, that we find the dukkha. Yeah. But of course, you know, they don't really just go just because we talked about it. Yeah. And the feeling of doubt can come in. So I don't know what I'm doing. And those who are leading us, they don't know what they're doing. And this Buddha guy, I'm not so sure, you know, maybe it was a she, that they knew what they were doing. And even if the grosser levels of these hindrances disappear, you'll notice they actually just got subtler. It's just like a subtler greed on experience. I think probably Zaha mentioned this kind of push and pull on experience, yeah. So it's not even clearly greed, it's just I'm pulling experience towards me, or I'm pushing experience away from me. Very, very subtle. You can see how subtle that could get. Maybe it's endless, endless work. And that's why the Buddha is saying, these all exist until this kind of total liberation, full awakening, yeah, which may or may not be coming for us personally, but just constantly working into this field, not disappointed that when they show up, but really feeling, there's something we can do. And that's exactly the framework of these Dharma teachings. Yeah? Dukkha is not a fixed state. It's not a done deal. It's not your sealed fate. Yeah, there is an escape. And, you know, I probably have like a silly imagination, but I kind of feel like the Buddha is going to break it. Like he knows that we're trapped, ensnared, you know, encircled by our hindrance patterns. And I'm in this little summer house cabin. I could just imagine, you know, there's some sound over there, and like the Buddha's going to like burrow their way into my room, and like just kind of come out all dusty and say, I've come to set you free, you know. Yes, thank you. But I am free. I can just walk out the door. I can go at any time. We kind of like don't understand what it actually means, how subtle this entrapment is. Yeah. And of course, this is kind of, those of you who kind of followed the story will know that there was this kind of hesitation in finding a sense of freedom, and then thinking, am I going to be able to explain this to anyone? Or are they just going to say, I don't need any prison keys, thank you. I don't need a map of the prison. I'm not in a prison. You know, I'm free already. You know, thanks for burrowing in here. But now I'm going to have to fill up that hole with something. Maybe I'll plant a tree. So, you know, now we have the keys. You know, the keys to find this freedom. Yeah. And the keys are, notice that there's dukkha. Notice that there is an escape. At the very least, we have the scheme for making the key, and this kind of vague map of how to kind of navigate our way out through the through the prison sewage system. You know, you always have to escape through the sewage system. You knew that, right? But it's a start, yeah. We've got a start on this. You know, peace is possible. Freedom is possible. Change is possible, right? Change, it's happening all the time. Not changing, that's the impossible thing. Like, try and not change. Just over the next half an hour, if you could just stay exactly as you are, right now, no change at all. You say it's impossible not to change. You're bound to develop, you're bound to change in some ways. And so, again, you know, just the key points from what I would say in relationship to these hindrances is that they always have antidotes. There's always something to do. And Zar shared those beautifully with us yesterday. You know, like, don't just sit there. Do something. Engage, play, explore, see what you can do. Understand that they always are shaping your experience, yeah? They're biased, like the news. Yeah, it's always biased. This isn't a representation of the world. This is a biased representation of so-called current events, yeah? Selective. And the hindrances are selective with a particular kind of invective. Yeah, they're often hypercritical, you may have noticed, yeah? That not good enoughness. And also, as I was saying there yesterday, you know, they're never personal. All pain, any pain we're going through, it's not my pain. It's not independently mine. It's part of a universal pattern. Yeah. Oh, this is what happens. Heartbreak, loss, achy legs, yeah, headaches. You're not the first person to have this. You won't be the last. Yeah. And all dukkha as well. It's universal. All these hindrances. The human defaults. Yeah. So we apply the antidote. We try and find the advanced settings. Yeah. They're not personal. It means it's not your fault. And find those illimitable heart qualities. The metta, the compassion. What we can do to meet life well, to meet uncertainty. So in an uncertain world, in a somewhat difficult to predict what's going to happen next in our lives, yeah, we can't arrange the conditions for peace, happiness, release. And the worldly winds speak of this changing world. In the Dharma, they speak of these eight worldly winds, fame and disrepute, yeah, or getting praise and getting blamed. It happens to us at times, yeah. So, oh, you're really great. Oh, actually, you're not so great. Oh, actually, that's really great how you took the news about not being so great. And it's just kind of like these winds, they blow in and out. You can't pin your existence on those, yeah, they come and they go. And there's gain and there's loss. So, oh, I've got this great new thing that I now have to look after and make sure no one else takes away from me. So, oh, I've lost that thing. Well, I've also lost the need to keep, you know, chasing after it. This gain and loss, they come and they go. Success and failure. Yeah. Joy and sorrow. Or pleasure and pain. And none of these things last. And we kind of invent these stories around these kind of passing events, yeah. Just as I invented one there, there's kind of a famous one that ignores that, you know, everything is going to change. There's a economics term for this, which is called regression to the mean. And you know, someone was explaining it that they were listening to the commentary of like some Olympic ski jumpers, and like someone has this kind of remarkable leap, and they said, oh, you have to watch out next time, probably going to hold back and not be able to repeat that, you know, again. And it's ignoring regression to the mean. You know, most jumpers, maybe they jump around 100 meters, you know, and then one jumper does 120. It's, oh, you know, there's so many circumstances going on, but they, you know, lay that responsibility on the psychology. Or someone has a bad leap. They say, oh, now he's got nothing to lose, or she's got nothing to lose. And so they do this far better than before. You know, and kind of just ignoring that, oh, it's just changing. It's the worldly winds. You know, sometimes you get lucky and you get the worldly wind, it gets you back and you get the 120. You know. Much more easily explained by regression to the mean. And we can kind of see, ah, equanimity is going to be handy here. A steadiness of the heart. It's like, oh, praise, thank you, thank you. Oh, blame, thank you, thank you. If things are bad, they'll likely get better. If they're if they're exceptionally great, they'll likely get slightly worse from there. Yeah, things come and go. But the story itself is not so predictable nor unpredictable. It's this kind of middle way. Things come and go. They sometimes they fall apart. Sometimes the jigsaw falls into place. All those pieces just come together, it lands together. But these Dharma teachings, what they're saying is we're not powerless in a world that doesn't listen to us. That's not the outcome of this, yeah? How we relate really matters. There's this beautiful story about the Dalai Lama. You know, they were asked about regrets in your life, and he replied that a student of his had committed suicide, and he had really felt regret and responsibility for not, you know, preventing the man's death. And the interviewer kind of probed and said, "Well, how did you get rid of such a feeling?" You know, because you see the Dalai Lama, he doesn't seem completely overwhelmed and depressed around this fact. And the Dalai Lama paused and then said, "Actually, I didn't get rid of that feeling. It's still there. But I don't allow it to drag me down and pull me back, because I realize that being dragged down by it or held back by it would be to no one's benefit, not mine or anyone else's. And so instead, I go forward and I do the best I can." So in that, I think that we can see we're not trying to get rid of pain. We're not trying to get rid of loss. Yeah. We can be saddened by pain, touched by loss. You know, even the Buddha grieved when his, you know, when those who were dear to him passed away. You know, he'd feel the pain of the love that now has no, not that same place to land. Yeah. A beautiful phrase for grief, you know, that feeling of love that doesn't have that place to land anymore. But that love is still there. Yeah. When we hear about others that think highly or lowly of us, we keep moving forward. Yeah. Still alive, still engaging. And this again is the wisdom and the courage of that equanimity that we can tune into at times, feel empowered to do. Yeah. And this is a teaching that is really well expressed and explained through a very readable sutta called the Salatha Sutta, also called the arrow or the dart. I say it's very readable. It's very male. There only seems to be men in this story, which is kind of a bit of a disappointment, you know, but maybe there were only men around 2,600 years ago. I'm not sure. No, there were clearly women, but for some reason they aren't many in this story, and I haven't rewritten it to fit out. But if you want to look it up, it's NN 36.6, SN 36.6, the arrow or the dart, relates to the second arrow, which is something that's often talked about. But don't be misled by the second arrow. There's often many more than that. Sometimes there's thousands of arrows. And the key in this whole story is to not fire the second arrow. But I think more clearly, it's not to fire the next arrow. Yeah. At any point in time, it's a good time to put that arrow, put that dart back into the quiver, take your quiver off, put your bow down, and just not fire another one. Yeah. So it starts like this. Monks, an uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, oi, he's talking about us, feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, feelings of neither pleasure nor pain. A well-instructed disciple of the noble ones also feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, feelings of neither pleasure nor pain. So this is kind of the full range of what you can feel. Oh, this is pleasant. Oh, this is unpleasant. Oh, this isn't really pleasant nor unpleasant. So whether we're, you know, well-instructed or uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, we get to feel these things. So it continues. So what's the difference? What distinction, what distinguishing factor is there between the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones and the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person? When touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental, just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow, and right afterwards were to shoot him with another one, so that he would feel the pains of two arrows. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught, so he feels two pains, physical and mental. And then, of course, because the Buddha didn't obviously see the potential for the well-developed self-inner critical, not just run-of-the-mill, super-advanced, you know, 3.0, person of the world today, we would then beat ourselves up for not being the well-instructed noble one, such, 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 and also fire a third arrow for not being good enough about that. And then we would think, why have I done that? That was so stupid. Don't I know anything? And fire the fourth arrow. It's like, oh, there I are. I've fired the fourth arrow. That's ridiculous. Well, I've got a fifth. Boom. You know, we carry on. We can go for a while until, you know, we're loading up and loading up and firing, yeah. And we see, you know, we are run-of-the-mill in the beginning, and it's not our fault for not being perfected and wise, you know. These are universal truths, and these are habitual patterns, and we are, you know, earthlings, worldlings. But they're not defaults we can't change. And so this is what's really quite delightful in there. It's just the difference is uninstructed or well-instructed. And so, you know, here are the instructions. Get to know, does this describe us? Yeah. So they continue. As the uninstructed is touched by that painful feeling, he is resistant, she is resistant. No, the push, yeah. Any resistance obsession with regard to that painful feeling obsesses him. Yeah, obsesses her. And it's such a beautiful language there. The resistance obsession. Yeah. So the obsession to resist actually obsesses us. We become obsessed by our obsession. Yeah. What an entanglement. Yeah. And you can see that's why it gets entangled. It's why some of these teachings are so clear, yeah. Touched by that painful feeling, he delights in sensual pleasure. Why is that? Because the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person does not discern any escape from painful feeling aside from sensual pleasure. That kind of flip from one frying pan into the fire. As he's delighting in sensual pleasure, any passion obsession with regard to that feeling of pleasure obsesses him. Right? So we had this obsession that entangled us around the unpleasant. And now we have this obsession which has entangled us around the pleasure. You see, it's working us both ways, the obsession leading to obsessions. It's entanglement. But the amazing thing is if you don't fire the next arrow, start to get more free, starts to open up. what this teaching says is he does not discern, as it actually is present, the origination, the passing away, the allure, the drawback or escape from that feeling. As he does not discern the origination, passing away, allure, drawback or escape from that feeling, then any ignorance obsession with regard to that feeling of neither pleasure nor pain obsesses him. Yeah. So by not seeing that there is an escape here, not seeing that this is just a temporary arising that could be met with kindness and care, yeah, could be dealt with our advanced settings. By not knowing that, by not seeing the drawbacks of getting entangled in obsession, we remain ignorant of that one and get obsessed again. Probably obsessed in not being good enough. Yeah. There's still more kind of juice in here, and I don't know, maybe we'll just have one more bit, because I think it points to something really quite important. Sensing a feeling of pleasure, he senses it as though joined with it. Yeah. Sensing a feeling of pain, he senses it as though joined with it. Sensing a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain, he senses it as though joined with it. This is called an uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, joined with birth, aging and death, with sorrows, lamentation, pains, distresses and despairs. He is joined, I tell you, with suffering and stress. And so this joined thing is, you can kind of feel it at times, you know, this sense of a kind of a fused awareness, me, pain, moment, it's all there, it's like an entrapment, an entanglement there. And in a sense, part of our path of practice is working with this fused awareness and working it into attentional flexibility. Yeah, both a flexibility of what we attend to and also a flexibility of how we attend. And so then the Buddha kind of goes on in his directions, you know, describing how the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones doesn't beat their breast, become distraught. So when they feel that one pain, they don't feel as if they've been shot by another. They are not resistance. So no resistance obsession with regard to that painful feeling obsesses them. Sensing a feeling of pleasure, he senses it disjoined from it. Sees, this is pleasure. And the interesting thing is, you can still enjoy, still be touched, still be moved, but also release. Yeah, like in that William Blake poem, to kiss the joy as it flies, lives in eternity's sunrise. This is the difference, this the distinction, this the distinguishing factor between the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones and the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person. And I hope, you know, if you feel that you're run-of-the-mill, I hope you realize that it's a great place to be. Got the whole run-of-the-mill. But the important thing to remember is, no matter how many arrows we fired, when we don't fire another one, yeah, we're turning that key in the lock of the prison, yeah, setting ourselves free. Reactive by default, yeah, but not fixed. You know, the body will experience pain. They use this word rupa in the Pali, which you translate as form. Like, why do you call it form? Because it deforms. Yeah. Because it falls apart. Because too much cold or too much heat impinge on the body. Yeah. And of course, it's not just the body. the emotions can be too much. And it's not just pain that can be too much, there can even be too much pleasure in a human body, which may seem absurd. But we can see there's always the possibility of engaging skillfully with this. And having our intentions clear is really important. Having our intentions clear is like, what am I trying to develop here? Because otherwise, maybe those default settings are gonna fire up. Yeah. What is it you want to develop? What is it you want to work on, get better at? One of my guitar teachers would say, you know, really pay attention to what you practice doing, because that's what you tend to get good at. And I think the same thing happens here is that also what we consciously make our efforts towards also shape our unconscious unfoldings. And the unconscious really matters. You know, maybe most of our life actually flows through in unconsciousness. But it's actually shaped by ideas that the heart and mind have about what I wish to do. Yeah. So in that sense of, you know, be aware of what you practice because that's what you'll be good at. Also, doesn't just apply to consciousness, it also applies to what we might call the subconscious rumination. Yeah, have you ever noticed, like, oh, I suddenly remembered something. So, oh, clearly the mind is working in the background through, you know, going through areas and things. I mean, oh, a bright idea pops up into the mind. The thoughts occur to us in this way. But it feels like probably they're triggered by where you placed your attention now. Will lead to future thoughts, future subconscious ruminations. You've probably noticed in meditations that the heart and mind will replay things that have appeared in consciousness before. It's like, you know, if you sit down and watch a box set and then meditate, you know, you will be influenced by the themes of your entertainment, yeah. Or like the dreams that we have. Many people become more aware of their dreams on retreats. So, oh, had that dream, had this dream. You can see that, you know, I'm not going to propose where dreams come from or where those raw materials really are arising, but part of them comes from what attention landed on in conscious times, yeah. Some of those dreams happen subconsciously. Some of those thought patterns happening subconsciously. My overarching idea around the mind is that it's trying to be helpful. It's trying to be helpful. It's trying to be useful to what we want to do. Yeah. I recently started thinking that it kind of might be working something like one of those shopping algorithms that kind of says, oh, I see you've been looking at lawnmowers. Would you like another lawnmower? It's like, you're not very smart, are you? I mean, I was looking for a lawnmower, but now I'm not looking for a lawnmower, but you want to keep offering me lawnmowers. Good, good, good. You know. Oh, and then maybe it'll say, oh, maybe you want a hedge trimmer. It's like, oh, give up, come on. And our minds are like that at times, aren't they? Yeah. So it's kind of unskillful, but with actually benevolent intentions. It's like, oh, I thought that's what you wanted. I thought that's what you were interested in. And it's kind of like the mind is a bit like an eager assistant. It's like, oh, would you like one of these? So we need to give clear directions, not contradictions. You know, if on the one hand I think, oh, I want to pay attention to subtle and beautiful things like breaths, like sounds without labels. But then when I'm given the choice, I'll watch things exploding on Netflix, you know, or I'll, you know, I'll say, oh, hang on, this isn't supporting, this isn't serving what I really need. So you have to be, no, I really want breaths. What I really want is breaths. That's what I want. I just want to pay attention to the breath with metta, and that's what I love. And so really sending those signals, that's what I enjoy. You know, there's a beautiful quote that we've used many times by Shinzen Palmo, There's a Mexican Zen monk, and he says, before buying anything, and I think within buying, we also mean tuning into, movie streams or whatever else, before engaging with anything, before consuming anything, let's say, just see if breathing is enough. Just see if breathing is enough. And if it can be enough, then perhaps that's going to send in the signal. It's like, you know what we need right now? A really nice breath. And that will really nourish, really soothe, really please what we are. Yeah. Because you may have noticed this, if you practice a lot of meditation, even if your mind wanders away, when you come back, sometimes it's deepened of its own. Yeah? So, I was off distracted, I've come back and it's more peaceful, it's more quiet. Or if you're learning an instrument, you can kind of see this really obviously. If you're learning to play something, and you practice, 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 you go away, you come back, oh, I got better. How? Not through practicing, just somehow some things aligned. So this can happen. So keep with it, keep with that dedication. Yeah, you're developing a skill. Yeah, and there's background learning. Maybe that's enough. That we can rest into, we can rely on the fact that there will be some background learning. So kind of like turn the wheel, set it in motion, meditate before going to bed, and then rest into that same space. So as we were saying about the balloon, keep that balloon inflated and take it with us, with presence, with mindfulness, as I move away, so that that sense of space is what the subconscious ruminates within. Because very often what we'll find is that the heart and mind will revert back to its default settings, what's referred to as tanha. So I shared with us yesterday, thirsting, clinging, demanding, pushing, pulling. And we're desiring for peace and ease, but actually going about it not in ways that it's going to come. So it's kind of unskillful attempts for not an unworthy goal. Yeah, you could have peace and ease. And this is exactly what the Buddha was encouraging, yeah? These Four Noble Truths are the escape plan. They are saying this isn't peaceful, but there is a peace possible. Yeah. We're trying to control our life, arrange our life, fix our life. And we can shape our life, but we can't control it. Yeah. They speak about this kind of web of karmic influences in the teachings, that it's like beyond the knowing of the most wise and clever, ingenious, bright beings, yeah. It's like a decentralized, distributed network of things all relying on all the participants to work together to kind of create it in this way. And then we come in and say, I'm in control of this, although I don't understand how it works and I don't know who any of you are, but if you wouldn't mind everything coming together just to be the way I like it for a while. So we obviously fall well short of control, but we do have a profound impact in the way that we relate. Yeah. And so the Buddha would like to say, to say that I'm in charge of all of this that I don't control. It's stressful. To act like I'm in control. It's absurd to take all of this as I, me, mine. And it doesn't make sense to take on what doesn't last in this way. It doesn't make sense to take on what's stressful. Yeah. Or outside of our control as ours. And so, kind of an invitation to another mode in which we actually just say, this is stressful. To fire this second arrow, this is stressful. This is not peaceful. This is not satisfactory. Yeah. And the interesting thing is that there's a way of ease that this brings. It brings the peace. It brings the ease in that very moment when we say, this is not peaceful. It's just slightly more peaceful for a moment. Ah, this isn't peaceful. This isn't easeful. There's also the possibility not to do that. It's an ease bringer. It's a bringer of joy. So there's actually a way of practicing, which is just to turn towards the way that we're relating and saying, this is unsatisfactory. Yeah. And it's not with any sense of complaint. Yeah, it's not with any sense of disappointment. But it's actually something that can support us to bring a deeper unification, yeah, a deeper steadying that we've developed already. Yeah. Like the whole body, heart, mind, moment, now. And then we say, this is unsatisfactory, this is not peaceful. You can feel that that actually lets go of something. And in that letting go, maybe there's a natural joy that's able to arise. I'm not going to fix this. You know, there's an experience that probably many of us have had, even today, you know, where you're sitting there and you're practicing, and you might be practicing metta, or you might be practicing, you know, this kind of unification, long breath, releasing contraction, things like that. And then all of a sudden you think, oh, it should be over by now, shouldn't it? You know, and then you kind of like switch into waiting for the bell to ring mode. Yeah, it's like, must be about 5 minutes left, I reckon. It's almost over. And we've switched from what we were doing, cultivating this beautiful quality, to this quite a normal expected pattern, yeah? The waiting for the bell to ring practice. And of course, be aware of what you practice, you know. We can get good at that. We can get good at 5 minutes. I could sit here for 5 minutes not doing anything. Get to the end, ring the bell, high fives all round, and we walk away, you know. So what? You had this chance to really cultivate something. If in those moments we see, oh, that's an unsatisfactory pattern. That's unsatisfactory to just wait for something to be over, to wish my life away. Yeah. And then with a kind of slow mindfulness, just get to know, what's this experience actually like? What's it like to be in the waiting for the bell to ring mode of attention? Yeah, and of course, this is a principle that we can transfer to anything that we're doing. And what you'll notice, when you bring interest to this moment that was a moment of aversion, there's less aversion there. So, oh, what's this like? There's less dukkha there. And so a shortcut for this is just to say, this is unsatisfactory. This is not release. This is not peaceful. Then we can get to know that. And this is a really powerful practice. Yeah, really powerful, really useful for meeting our life, this uncertain life, and seeing, oh, is this a pattern that's unsatisfactory? And really clear, this is not rejection. Yeah. But it's just seeing something for what it is. Yeah. And so I hope it makes sense, but even if it doesn't, I'm going to invite you to practice with it tomorrow. And then when we try it out, I hope that we'll see that declaring something as unsatisfactory actually is joyful, really quite enjoyable. That we actually put down, release, some long-held, unhelpful patterns. So let's just have an unsatisfactory moment of silence together to close. So thank you for your kind attention, thank you for your practice. So we'll have some time now for walking, and then we'll come back for the last sitting of the day.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.